Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. Thanks so much for joining me for another edition of TCM's Private Screenings Uncut. Chance for you to hear the entire conversation I had with a legendary talent from Hollywood's golden age. You know, when we tape these interviews, we usually sit and talk for at least 2, maybe 2.5, or 3 hours, but only a fraction of that material makes it into the final edited show. Well, these Private Screenings Uncut audio podcasts let you hear all the material we captured that day. And this month's installment is an interview we first premiered on TCM in April of the year 2000. It's Private Screenings' Rod Steiger, a conversation I had with the Academy Award-winning actor, who I must say had the reputation of being a very intense and intimidating man, but over the course of the time we did talk, I found him to be very interesting, as expected, but also charming and funny. We actually began our talk discussing Rod's reputation for being so intense, but we also talked about the effect his childhood had on him as an actor and as a man. Rod also talks about his brief stint in the Navy and how he used to while away the long hours on duty and his attempts to entertain his shipmates while working the graveyard shift. Rod also goes into how he took his first steps into becoming an actor, his time at New York's prestigious Actors Studio, and why he thinks that particular workshop helped him so much, not only when acting on stage, but also in live television and, of course, when he was working in films. And what an amazing film career he had, too. On the Waterfront, The Pawnbroker, Dr. Zhivago, of course, In the Heat of the Night, and so many more. Rod talks about all those films and also about why winning an Academy Award meant a lot to him and his disappointment in director Alia Kazan for naming names during the Blacklist era. Rod also talks frankly and freely about his struggles with depression and how it almost brought an early end to his career. So here, originally recorded in November of 1999 and first shown in its edited TV version on TCM in April of the year 2000, part one of TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Rod Steiger.
Rod, since 1954, the world's been very aware of Rod Steiger, and we think we know you. And what's the one thing, probably more than any other, that we don't know about you or have all wrong about you?
I think from a professional point of view, I'm a frustrated would-be Frank Sinatra.
Really?
Yeah, I have my daughter's an opera star in Europe, Anna Steiger, and I always had an exceptionally good voice operatically, but I had no ear. So I'd be going along and everything would stop, and I said, what's the matter? I said, you changed key, you know. And I said, well, I better become an actor then. I'll never make my living doing this, but she does very well. That would have been it, a saloon singer. If I could sing, you couldn't shut, well, you can't shut me up anyway, but I would love that.
Are you as intense a person as you appear to be on the screen?
I don't know. I think the only way I can answer that objectively is to say that when you work, the fear of failure can make you a little more intense than when you're in your own private life, where you're in more or less in command of everything, and you're not risking your reputation or the possibility of looking like an idiot in front of the world. So that makes me a little bit intense, you know. Also, my whatever intensity I had, that goes back. I figured it out. They gave me an award in Chicago 2 years ago for making pancakes. I don't know what the hell it was. Anyway. And as I got it, I said to the people, because I don't like to know what I'm going to do, I just realized my family was destroyed by alcohol. And, of course, the neighbors were merciless, and the children were worse to me about the name Steiger, the drunkard, your mama's a drunkard, and this and that. And I realized then, somewhere inside of me, I must have said, you're going to do something good enough, they're not going to laugh at that name anymore. They're not. And I realized, and that's true, I realized that that's part of whatever I got, or intensity, whatever it is. They're not going to laugh. If I can help, they're going to respect it. So that's my button, I guess, is disrespect. I can't stand that.
I'm going to get back to that in a minute about your childhood. I want to ask you first about picking the roles that you pick. You seem to pick roles that challenge not only you, but an audience that watches the movies.
Well, challenge is a place of incredible excitement. and fear. I mean, I don't understand people who can play the same part like they do on some series for 22 years. I mean, I'd become a robot. And also, I believe acting is exploring life in front of an audience. And if you can have the courage to do that, sometimes you can give the world something which is the highest gift you can give them, which is a pleasurable memory. That's as far as I can go, something you warmly remember. And also, of course, I was one of my idols always was Paul Muni. And I believe actors are supposed to create different human beings. When I hear an actor say to me, well, that's bad for my image, I say, you poor son of a bitch, you only got one image. That's sad, you know.
Paul Muni was a great actor. Was he, besides being a hero to you, were there others like Paul Muni that inspired you?
Well, I had a lot of foreign actors. You see, in New York, they had a little theater called the Thalia Theater on the West Side, and they had a summer festival. You'd go there and be able to see, like, Grapes of Wrath and Grand Illusion, two great classics that only played one day. And by the time the month, that's as long as it lasts, was over, you could tell the people were interested in acting because their eyes looked like bullseyes. They were red. And a French actor named Harry Bauer and Pierre Frenet and those people impressed me. But the basic thing is, I guess it's the thrill of going somewhere you've never been before with the hopes of making a credible memory or exciting memory. Yeah.
Had you originally thought you'd spend more time in the theater, though, than in front of a camera?
No. Oh, in the theater originally? No. Mm. No, I didn't ever. I was kind of forced because of my childhood and that to go one day at a time. Because if I projected anything in the future because of the circumstances around me, I'd be disappointed or something.
Let's talk about your childhood. Your father, you didn't know your father.
I didn't know him, no. His name was Frederick Steiger. And he was supposed to be able to play any instrument by ear and a great dancer and very handsome. But I didn't know. The only thing is, I always used to wonder, like when I was on Broadway doing a play, if this man came into the dressing room and said, I'm your father, I don't know if I beat the bejesus out of him or break down crying. I've always wondered what would happen at him. You know, where were you? Or I just go to pieces, you know.
So you never met your father?
No, in fact, I'm a little more angry. He's probably long gone, but I'm a little more angry now that he never came backstage.
Your mother, you said, was
my
an alcoholic.
My mother was a very beautiful woman with long auburn hair who, I remember we drove across country to come to Hollywood, and she wasn't on the beach an hour. They offered her a movie contract. And she was in love with this man, Walter Tours, who was my stepfather, and she didn't take it. And then she got some kind of an affliction in her right leg, and they did an operation that went wrong, and she had to swing it from the hip, and she started drinking then, and then she became an alcoholic. And she had a very good singing voice. So she was a frustrated performer. And when I got a little lucky in my profession, I remember after she passed on at my house arrived a huge steamer trunk. And inside of it, if there was one line about me, they all were clipped out. Mm-hmm. But she was living that through me, you know, which is fine if it gave her any joy.
Did she live to see you win the Academy Award?
She died 2 months before.
No.
That's one of my regrets, you know. But I always, I didn't like her. I hated her guts because I was on my own. I was about 10 or 11. And I lived in the neighborhood with various people. When I was 16 and a half, when the war just, I think the day or two before, though, anyway, I went looking for her. Because I wanted her to sign a piece of paper that gave permission to me to go in the Navy at 16 and a half instead of 17. And I found her in the equivalent of a flop house downtown in Newark. And she was gone. She was like there. And I'll never forget, I said, Ma, I want you to sign this. Why? I said, because I want to go away. I want to go to the Navy. I didn't sign it. I said, you'll sign it. I took her arm, put it behind her back. I'll break your arm. I said, that's how desperate I was. And we're both standing there crying. And she wouldn't sign. I had her arm. And finally, she had to sign it. And I took the paper and ran all the way to New York. I went in the Navy, you know. I'll never forget that.
Those are devastating memories to have as a kid, to grow up with.
Well, you know, nature has no mercy when it comes to what's going to make up a memory, I guess.
Was the Navy a great release for you then, to be away from home?
I didn't think of it that way. This is all in retrospect. I just wanted to get away. I remember when I was in the 50s, if you didn't go to a psychoanalyst, you were sick, right? Everybody had to have his own doctor. My doctor said this, my doctor said that. So I went, and the doctor said to me, well, one of the things, after a while, you have a horror of discomfort, which, of course, goes back when I could hear, you know, we live in a little cold water flat, and I could feel and sense, because your instincts, I believe, far before the intellect, you knew there was going to be another fight between the mother and father. You could feel it like that. And I never forgot that. So I had a horror of discomfort. And then the other story that's funny about analysis was my first visit, I sat with the doctor. I said, now look, you've got to understand something. I have to be free. I must be free to read what I want. I must be free to go where I want. I must be free to get up what I want. I must be free to go with whom I want. I must be free. I must have freedom. This is one of the statements that changed my life. He said, you be careful or you'll become a slave to freedom. I said, what time's the next visit? I couldn't get around that, you know. That and another phrase, I remember I had an old acting teacher named Rikon Benary, who played with Stanislavski and also the Habima Theater in Russia. And I always was fairly inventive. And I remember one day I was doing this scene and I had to answer a telephone. And I said to myself, there must be another way to answer a phone. You pick it up, you put it down, you pick it up, you put it down. So an actor never knows where help is going to come from mentally. And out of left field, I thought of Will Rogers and his lariat. So I picked up the wire, and I had a great time, and I caught it. I don't think I could ever catch it again. The scene was over. The class was so impressed with that. And I remember he had trouble English. And he said, Rod, and if he said this word, I know it was dead. He says, that was very theatrical. But muzhdada nana nuzhna. He said something like that in Russian. And this is another phrase I use all my life. I said, what does that mean? He said, possible, but not necessary. And to this day, when I was younger, you want to go out with that girl? It's possible. You know, not necessarily. You want to do it, it's possible. And when I work, sometimes I use that as a way of kind of editing my work. I said, yeah, that's possible, but it's not necessary. You know, I'll never forget those two things, slave to freedom and possible but not necessary.
What did you do in the Navy?
I was a torpedo man, and I had the mechanical ability of Pinocchio, do you understand? And they put me in torpedo school, and it has 2,000 working parts inside of it. It's about 23 feet long, and I thought they were out of their mind. And so then I was in torpedo school, and then I was on a destroyer. And the thing at a destroyer, we were out for a couple of months and we'd come alongside a supply ship or something and get our stuff, so we didn't see land that much. And of course, in the Navy, we were considered the real Navy. The destroyer people, anything above, bigger than a destroyer, you were in a hotel. We used to call them the hotel. How's the hotel? We used to yell at the guys, how you doing up there? You got a good suite? You know. And one of the things was, on my destroyer, there's a torpedo tube. That's three long tubes that face the same way the ship is going, like that. And then, of course, if you're going to use them, they swing to the left and swing to the right. And you're in a little tin shell, like, inside, and you get the orders from the captain, and you go this way. So it would be boring, 12 to 4 in the morning, right, to watch. And they had the battle phones. And if you use the battle phones for anything else but battle, it was about 10 years automatic in the prison in Newport. Does that stop Big Rod? Of course not, right? I pressed the button, and I used to say, good evening. This is the shadow speaking. Her alabaster globes gleamed in the moonlight. I won't go any further, but my program, I'm telling you, was filthy, right? And I've got the whole ship listening to me because they're trapped on the battle. And I'm doing great for about a week and a half. And I got the 12 to 4 watch again, and I said, good evening. This is the shadow speaking. And the captain's voice from the bridge says, this is the Phantom, Steiger. Shut the F up. You never saw a network go off the air as fast as we went, you know. But that was entertainment, man.
When did the acting bug bite for real?
I don't know. I tell you, it never bit me that way. When I came out of the service, I didn't know what to do because I only had 1 year of high school and I had nothing to contribute to society because I was not educated. And I was working in civil service. I don't know how they do it. One letter takes four people who are related to take it from the fourth floor to the fifth floor. I don't know. I'm just observant, not condemning, right? And all the pretty girls disappeared on Thursday night. And the guys were checking each other. Said, what the hell is this? Where are they? And now this is a block square building, the Office of Dependents and Beneficiaries, right? With about 7,000 employees, I mean. So they organized a theater group. And they had all these women, the pretty ones, went into the theater group. But they had no men. We descended like vultures. May we get lucky with the girls, right? So I did two little shows, one-act plays. And this was the phrase that changed my life. The woman, her name was Rose Palfrey, said, you should take it serious. I said, you're kidding, are you out of your mind? I mean, these are the golden people. You see them up on the screen. When I was a kid, I washed the dishes or helped my mother dry and took out the garbage. I got 10 cents. I went to see them on Saturday. Now, but she said, well, you have to study. And I said, I don't have the money. And then she reminded me of something that I'm sure millions of men were reminded of in the United States at that time. The GI Bill of Rights, which I will be eternally thankful for, because without it, I never would have become an actor.
And explain what that was a bit.
The GI Bill of Rights was if you had 4 years in service, you could go most about any college you want for 4 years. So I said to myself, what the hell, this is better than working civil service. I'll go make believe I'm an actor. This is a terrible thing about being an actor, by the way. Anybody can say he is. You know, I can't say, I'm a painter, say, let me see the painting. Like a pianist, let me hear you play, right? So I went over, and of course, the New School of Social Research, dramatic workshop. And of course, with all due respect, they wanted the government check, which they knew would be there. So you got up and said, I feel, they said, wonderful, fresh quality, marvelous, talented, bang. They wanted to check. And I, at one time, I went to the dramatic workshop, the American Theater Wing and the Actor Studio, all at the same time. I was on stage once a week someplace, which I think is very important because the new intellectual knowledge you're getting in relation to acting, you can actually test by your life experiences on the stage. Then you begin to understand what concentration is. When they first say to me, concentrate, the young actor thinks, well, or I shouldn't have heard that door slam off stage. I shouldn't have seen the set shake. And that's not, concentration is you make one thing more important than everybody else, everything else. So you see the set shake, but you want to explain this to the other person, you know.
So when did that take hold then? Was that, I mean,
oh,
when
after
you
about 2 months, so they so used to laugh then. At me because I walked around, you know, those cases that the pilots have, the black cases mm-hmm. they come on the plane with. In its side of it was the story, the history of theater and makeup and fencing and Vakhtangov and Danchenkov and Stanislavski and Boleslavski and all of them. And they used to call me the walking library. Here comes the library. But then I really got obsessed with them. See, there's another thing behind everything that I believe. I am in one of the few professions in the world. And if you can make a decent living, excuse me, somebody said, you work so hard. You're so serious. I said, my friend, I break my rear end for 3 months. You see, I'm back to freedom. I can do what I want for 9 months. So I'm still back with the romantic idea of freedom. And it's true. If I get lucky enough, and I have been, I have control of the greatest currency in the world, which is the time of my life. Not monetary. That I got enough that I can do what I want to do, basically. And that, to me, is a perk that's incalculable.
Rod, when did you get, like, seriously into the Actors Studio?
Well, what happened there was that I never auditioned. And one of the reasons I didn't know, I was scared to death to audition anything, never mind the Actors Studio. And I was studying with Danny Mann, the director, who did Come Back, Little Sheba, and a lot of plays on Broadway. And at the end of the semester at the new school, he said to one or two people, you come an audition at the studio in September, and you come, and here I am. I knew instinctively that he, you know, had some respect for my ability, and he didn't say anything. Well, I packed my bag, I walked, I was destroyed. And he's walking down 44th Street, ahead of me about a quarter of a block, and I'm looking and I'm thinking, I don't understand, I did work as good as they did. And he turns around and he said to me, Rod, I'll see you in the studio in September. I didn't have to audition.
Great.
But I'll never forget those 10 minutes. I'll tell you that. So then I went there and it was wonderful. There was all sorts of people there.
Did it have an incredible influence on you?
Incredible? Well, see, I always will be respectful of the Actors Studio. I don't know what the Actors Studio is like today. I see this program, they have the Actors Studio, but for me it feels more regimented. It's with the school now, the new school. But yes, because I will always be indebted because not from an intellectual point of view, but from a life experience. It gave me a place to rehearse. It gave me a place to be wrong without being fired. It gave me a place where I could take chances without being dismissed. And that's very important because, first of all, I hope it improves your technical ability to help your talent flower, so to speak. But also, you don't know it, but indirectly, it's building up a thing called courage. You know, I've done some things people said, my Lord. And when you make it, it's great. When you don't, you look like a jackass. But when you make it, you're the only one who did. And I'm not talking about money at any time in this conversation. I remember one of the things, you come off stage or I finish a scene in a movie, and somebody said, wow, what was that? And I said, I don't know. but I'm not going to do it again, I'll tell you that, you know. So that's, it gave me experience enough to have courage and also whatever talent I have to control it or develop it.
Wasn't it a great endorsement in the 50s, though, also to be a member of that?
Oh, I mean, you
that
were was very like, proud.
Yeah.
You're very proud. So you'd be interviewed for a job by somebody who says, I'm also a member of the Actors Studio. Then about 10 years later, if you said that, the guy on the other side of the desk said, well, who isn't? And I think one of the things that hurt the studio, in my opinion, when they started to invite, like, Joan Crawford and these people to be observers, who were the antithesis. But that was Strasberg. Strasberg was starstruck. He and Marilyn Monroe, come on. You know, and that was very disappointing. Very, he was a very bright intellectual. And then I used to have fights with him, one of the few people. I said, Lee, you got to divide the studio into groups, like the Stanislavski thing. You have the beginners, the intermediates, you have the seniors. The seniors on the weekend should be doing scenes for the public. And you can't have people, you go in there, I was there for years, and you hear invariably the same thing over and over because he's really talking to the beginners. And we lost some of our best talents. I don't know if I'm accurate about this, but I think one was... we have a great talent in this country. I don't know what's left of her. Could name Kim Stanley, wonderful actress. And I don't know for personal problems what happened. Anyway, her career didn't go that far. But she was a fireball. I mean, she did Bust Up on Broadway and that. And she could do more with one look than you could do with a paragraph. And she does this scene which has an emotional challenge you can't believe. You say, my God, how did she get herself there? And when it was over, some young girl wanted to impress Strasberg, put up her hand, said, yeah. Lee said, what? I didn't think the teapot was hot the way she handled it. And I don't know if it was Kim or not, but I think so. She stood up and said, that does it, Lee. I'm around the corner. My name's above the title on Broadway. I'm not talking about... I keep about 120 people employed. I'm not talking about me. I break my ass. And this girl who wants to get your attention makes something up about a teapot. If she wants me to do a hot teapot, I'll show her the damnedest hot teapot you ever saw. And she left, and she never came back. And a lot of good talents did. You know, and a lot of times people would say something to get his attention, you know. I don't believe I once, my first acting teacher was this man, I said, from the name Rikan Benari, that's my name. And he got sick, and I was doing Al Capone. I was up at 5 in the morning. I rewrote Capone for about 30 days, which is another story. And I worked all day. Anyway, his wife calls me up and said, Rod, we're going to lose money. You're going to lose this class. So I took over the class, and my first class, everybody's sitting there waiting for method and all sorts of stuff. And I brought in two very good reproductions, one of Cezanne, one of Van Gogh. I brought on Clair de Lune by Debussy and the Eroica by Beethoven. I brought in a poems by Hausmann, Frost, E.E. Cumming, and Shakespeare. I told two of the best jokes that I could think of. And I don't, that was about it. Now everybody's, and it took about an hour and a half. I said, that's it, that's the class. And if none of this move you, get out. Get out, you're wasting your time. You know, acting, you have to know a little bit of everything. You know, you're not going to be a jack of all trades. You should be a jack of acting. But like I said with the Lariat, an actor has to, if I hadn't read about Will Rogers and that, I'd never known about the Lariat. I can sit here and all of a sudden, 2 months from now, I said, there's something, there's like something dazzled him. I said, oh, yes, the reflection off the polish on this gentleman's shoes. That's what it's like. So you don't know. It can come from the most excruciating moments in your life, banal moments in your life, observations, you know. Like there's a certain flower they have in California. I don't know what the hell it is, but it smells terrible when you put it in the house. The one looks like a starfish. Mm. And the director said to me, this guy smells like, oh, I don't have to go any further. You don't have to get intellectual, my friend. I got the message, you know. But if you don't, if you haven't tried to be aware of all these things, I don't mean you walk around like that, but just open, you lose a great reservoir of inspirational possibilities.
So you sort of moved away from the Actor's Studio too then?
Well, no, I got lucky. I started to work, you know, and I used to go back whenever I could. And I haven't really been back long enough, I mean, the last 10, 15 years, and it's all kind of changed in my opinion. But still, it is very worthy because, above all, you can get on stage once, twice, three times a week, twice a week if you want to.
Now, you were also doing a lot of live television at this point, right?
Oh, my God. I did my first TV show in 1947. That was something. They had the lights. And they didn't have the lights like they have now. They had little lights, hundreds of them. And your makeup used to cascade down your face, right? You didn't know where you were. And you could hear the actors going to the other set like running when one scene. And you held your microphone in close-ups and you threw it through the stage manager, right? But live television, you learned, whether you knew it or not, one of the basic things. Never mind the lines, my friend. What is this scene about? If something goes wrong with the lines, that doesn't mean, if I know what the scene about is. And I also learned one of the great secrets of acting. Because in the beginning of acting, for many years, all of us acted as if the entire world had read the script first. It's true. And if we change something, 2 billion people are going to stand up and say, no, it was the man, not a man. And I improvise a lot when I work, because I believe an actor should be able to change anything but the thought of the line and the cue for the other actor. A good director, you know, just say in your own words whatever makes you comfortable, long as the cue is right for the other actor. But I remember it took me years to say, wait a minute. I discovered that on Broadway I was doing Rashomon, a theatrical version of the film. And I said, they don't know. I can give them anything I want, except it must be logical and truthful. If I want to start, if acting goes from 1 to 10, I want to start to 7, bounce back to 3, go to 2, and then back to 1. It's okay, long as it all adds up in the end. That's the privilege you have of creating. And then you don't hear people talk about this anymore much, but it's called like counterpoint music. That's what I did when I first started. One of the things that makes a villain most frightening is he doesn't act like a villain at all, and as he says goodbye, he shoves a knife in your stomach, and the public says, holy Christ, he was like one of us. What? That's frightening. And I walk around and say, now listen, you know. And so all these things are ways an actor can try to create something, you know. And I always tried not to repeat parts. I mean, try to do different people as much as I could.
That's the Paul Muni influence again.
Yeah. Also, it's the excitement of it, you know.
Now, in 1951, Fred Zinnemann cast you in your first film, Teresa.
Yeah.
I believe. Now, that was filmed not in Hollywood, but in Europe. But how did that come about with Fred Zinnemann?
In New York.
Done in New York.
I think. I don't know what happened. Oh, yeah, that came out of Marty. He had seen it, you know. That's the original Marty I did on television, and they made a movie out of it later. I didn't do it because they say you'd have to sign a 7-year contract. I said, I can't do that. I don't want to become a slave to anything. And then I said, all right, maybe I'll do it. See how the freedom thing comes in again? I said, maybe I'll do it. Who selects my part? And Burt Lancaster and Harold Heck said, we will. I said, no. I reserve the right to sleep with whom I please. And if I'm going to make a mistake, I want it to be my mistake, not something I was forced to do because of my contract. So I lost Marty, which broke my heart. But then Zinnerman got me into Oklahoma, you know, about a week later. So, but that came about.
But back to Teresa. How did you first meet Teresa? That came about through Marty,
I think.
Wow.
Fred Zinnerman became a very good friend of mine for years. He was one of the best directors ever. He had a sense of honesty and integrity that he refused to give up. And the sad story was he told me over lunch before he left Hollywood 15 or whatever it was years ago, we're having lunch. I said, what's up? And he had a little German accent. He said, do you know, I walked into, I'm talking about Nunn's story and all these great pictures he did. I walked in to see this man at a studio, a young man. They had the Armani suit, the gold earring in the ear. And he said to me, Mr. Zinnerman, what have you done? And I looked at him and I said, young man, what have you done? And I got up, I went home and told my wife, we're going back to Europe. That's sad. That's sad. Yeah. Lovely man.
Great director.
Oh, yeah.
Great director. After Teresa with Fred Zinnerman, I believe your second film was On the Waterfront.
Yeah.
And how did that come about?
That came about because of Marty. When Kazan, who I have no respect for now because of the way he sold his friends in Washington at all, Elijah Kazan, I came to go, we had classes, I think it was Friday, and I came to class after I had done Marty a week before, and he said, what the hell did you do on television? All I hear is this Marty, Marty, Marty. I said, well, I don't know, Nancy Marshall, and I think we did a good show, you know. Well, he said, you go and read the taxi scene in Waterfront with Bud Schulberg, who wrote the script, and if he likes you, you can play Marlon Brando's brother. Well, I almost fell on the floor, because I had seen Brando in Streetcar about 2 weeks before, in which he was absolutely magnificent, and I couldn't believe it. And I went and I read with Mr. Schulberg the taxi scene, and I got the part. So that was another derivative of Marty.
Now, how did you get along with Kazan at that point?
Fine. He was our father image. That's what killed us at the studio when we heard about this. That our father, it was like you heard your father sleeping with your sister.
But hadn't that happened before Waterfront?
It happened just in the middle, and I didn't know it. Because I have an abhorrence of politics. I mean, E. Cummings, the poet, says a politician is an ass to be sat upon, right? That's how I feel about politics. So I didn't know till I was, the day I invited Lee J. Cobb to come to my little apartment and have spaghetti with me. Just before, 20 minutes before we got in the car, somebody says, I think there's something you don't know. And it was that Cobb had given names and Kazan had given names. And Cobb was one of my idols, Death of a Salesman and that. And I sat that whole dinner talking to the knot in his tie or between his eyes. I couldn't, you know, look him in the eyes. I never forgot that.
How about Brando? Had you known him before?
I didn't know him at all. He was very professional. I didn't know what he was doing at first because we got in the cab, and I'm a wreck now because I'm dealing with the white hope of the theater and the cinema and everything else at the time. So we get ready to shoot, and he says, how's Ma? That's not in the script. But we both came from the same kind, so I figured, well, he's searching for something. I said, I don't know. She, you know, she's all right as far as I know. And he said words like, well, you know, I was thinking about it. And I said, look, because I begin to get irritated. She's fine. You sure? I said, look, you got her phone number. You put 10 cents in the phone, you dial a number, say, Ma, how are you? Cut. We start again, and he says, what do you think of the Yankees? That's not in the script. And I said, you're very, and you know, when you can improvise within the framework what the playwright gives you, you can get away with murder. I said, you're very strange today. I don't understand. Our father used to drag our asses to the Dodgers because we came from Brooklyn, remember? And you're asking me about the Yankees? Cut. And then it was only years later I realized maybe this man was not being too kind to me.
Setting up you up to make you fail on...
I don't know what he was trying to do, but it wasn't creative, that's for sure.
Now, was a lot of the dialogue in that scene improvised?
Not really.
As it was?
Some of it was, some of it wasn't. You see, dialogues are like the ribs on a skeleton. You can put all sorts of things around them as long as you don't change, as I said before, the thought and the cue, and it gives the actor more freedom. If he has the ability to improvise a bit. I've worked with actors, and they don't know it, but they try to copy your way of working, and they go way off someplace. We have to stop. I don't say anything, but we have to stop because they thought they're going to improvise too, you know.
That scene is now one of the great classic scenes in cinema.
I was amazed because we did the scene, took about 11 hours, and I got very upset because we did the two-shot and then his close-up, and acting is basically reacting, so it all depends who's off camera to help you. And if you're any kind of an actor, when you're off camera, you overdo it, or you change things, right? You're supposed to say you're no good. You say you are a rotten son of a bitch, and the guy, you know, and you get, it's mm-hmm. like directing in a way, mm-hmm. and you get the reaction you wanted. So I was knocking myself out, and then they came to do my close-ups, and I said, "Where Marlon?" They said, "He went home." I said, "Okay." So it must have burned his rear end. We came out pretty even in that scene. But I'm talking about a man now years ago. I met him once 2 years ago in Toronto, and they had given me an award the night before, and he sent this most flowery telegram, you know. And I love Chinese food, so I'm sitting there Chinese food, and I see him there sitting at a table with some people. He's there. And I said, well, I got to go over and thank him for the telegram, for Christ's sakes. So I went over and I said, well, Marlon, I'm really sorry you sent me the telegram. He said, why? Is it because I can't say anything shitty about you anymore? That's why. We both kind of broke up, and that was the end of that. 44 years later, not that I would remember a thing like that.
Did you have any idea that that film was going to be a hot film when you made it?
No, I think the only thing a performer, an artist has, they feel in their stomach, as I always said, it's good material. Mm-hmm. Like when I did Marty, I didn't know. The next day I came downstairs in TV, I'm talking about, a woman goes by with three poodles. She said, what are you going to do tonight, Marty? Which was a line from the movie, which was a cue for me. And I said, I don't know. What are we going to do? Garbage truck goes by. Two guys yell, what are you going to do tonight, Marty? By the time I got my corn muffin and tea, the guy gives me my tea and said, what are we going to do tonight, Marty? I knew something had happened. And that character's loneliness touched the whole country. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, 1 hour. That taught me the power of television. 1 hour, 365 days.
How about that scene where you're on the hook in On the Waterfront?
Well, that was difficult because it was freezing. We had two sun lamps, one on each side of the camera, and the camera would freeze anyway. Just stop. And Marlon came over and helped me in that because if you took a breath, you saw it. So he said, well, you should try to get yourself to your, like, hyperventilate. You know, go, get, and it worked. Because I thought he'd never take me down. You know, he came and he looked. And but I have to thank him for that. And then when he put me over his shoulder with my rear end towards the camera, I took another breath. You couldn't see it in the air. You know.
Now, this kind of established you. This is your second film, and... rather established you off the bat as a villain or
Well, I don't consider. First place, I don't. An actor cannot judge the character he's playing.
Right.
If he does that, he makes a big mistake. I don't know what a villain is. I don't know what a straight part is. All I know is, right now, what I want is to clarify to you my perception of what makes a character, and that's all I'm in. If I do it in a crappy way, I'm a villain. If I do it in a nice way, I'm not. So you can't judge your characters like trying to judge a stranger before you had a chance to get them to know them, you know? So I finally learned that.
But it certainly had people offering you a lot of parts in which
I got parts of people who were lonely. I got parts of people who were not nice, you know? And then they used that tired old phrase in the movie magazines, the man you love to hate, like Eric Stroheim. Von Stroheim, and I think the reason it worked is because I never tried to play him as a villain. Because no matter what I do, as I said before, the most frightening thing is that I'm very nice to you and suddenly I just cut your throat as I'm walking out. That's scary. The audience going to die. I thought it was like the guy next door. My God, you know.
You were nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, along with two other actors from On the Waterfront. Lee J. Cobb and Carl Malden were also nominated. Yeah. Did you think you had a good chance to win that year?
I did not, because too many people were nominated from the same movie. And I didn't worry about it. I was amazed, you know.
So you were up for On the Waterfront and didn't win. Then you were up for The Pawnbroker. How did you feel your chances were that year?
Well, I thought it was such a powerful drama, I had a good chance. You know, I was shocked when I didn't win it.
It did come as a surprise. Did you have your speech ready?
No, I don't like to know what I'm going to say. Even when I work, I like having an interview. I don't want to know what you're going to ask me. But I thought I had a pretty good chance because nothing had the weight of the dramatic power of that film.
So the next year, or a couple years later, you were up for In the Heat of the Night, and indeed did win.
Yeah.
Was that a thrill for you?
Well, yes. It's if you win anything, and you win it on your own terms. By that I mean, by and large, I didn't advertise too much. Hypocritically, I let the producers do that, but I didn't go around the parties. I didn't, you know, I wanted to get it for the quality of my work, and by and large, I did, you know. And what I wanted it for was, after you win the Academy Award, until you make your first mistake, by that I mean you do a picture that doesn't make money, you get the best scripts, you get the best directors, you get the best actors to work with. That's what I was
So it thinking. Really does work that way.
Yeah, because, well, monetarily, you're hot, that terrible word I hate. And so these scripts come to you automatically, but from a creative point of view, here I have a better chance working, as I say, better actors, better the scripts, better the everything.
Shortly after that, you had a wonderful script and a wonderful movie, No Way to Treat a Lady.
Oh, yeah, I loved that because I was very cocky then. I figured, well, I played six or seven different parts. That's my answer to Mr. Peter Sellers, you know. And I enjoyed that because, it was like a black comedy, and I could have a chance to do something that was comic or entertaining that way. And also, again, I'm trapped there. I have different characters. I show off a little bit, you know.
Great script and great results.
Well, yeah, thank you. That the last scene was more or less improvised, where he gets shot and dies. You know, a lot of people resented that scene. They thought it was too strong for the picture, but I thought it was right for the character.
Well, the picture also walks such a narrow line,
yeah,
you know, between
Mike
comedy and,
a very
and
nice director.
About a serial killer, and yet it's a comedy, you know,
yeah.
And wonderfully done. You also did a very daring film around that time, The Sergeant.
Well, I want to do The Sergeant again. The Sergeant was about this man who was all army and all macho and had all the medals God ever made, and he's in charge of this camp. Outside of Paris, there's no war going on, about the 60s or so. And he gets drunk one night, and then there's this soldier, and suddenly kisses him, which comes as a shock to everybody. And instead of getting help, or instead of trying to find out what was happening, the rigidity, that was a tragedy of rigidity, he mentally put himself on, next morning takes a rifle, goes out in the trees and blows his brains out. So it's a very strong picture. It was way ahead. I mean, I'd love to do it again now because it's a wonderful story and you could do it very economically.
Are there many films you feel that about that you'd like to do again, that you would take and start from scratch?
I don't think so. The Sergeant is one because of the change of the mores in society in relation to homosexuality or what have you, where it's more understood as part of life, as it should be. I don't think so, you know.
Are there many films that you've made that you thought would hit or strike a chord that didn't? Just the opposite of In the Heat of the Night?
Well, you'd sometimes do a picture you think is going to be good. That's the only way I can, you know. And then, let's face it, I had a special problem. I have a clinical depression. It stopped me dead for almost a decade. And in Hollywood, they give you an award on Friday and don't know your first name on Monday. And I figured, oh, my, that's it. And the thing that saved me was television. Television was showing my films. And the younger generation said, he's not bad, this guy, and it kept my name alive, you know. So I'm very thankful for that. Then when I finally, after 8.5, almost 10 years, overcame the clinical depression and started to work again, but it was television with the old films that kept me malleable as far as Hollywood is concerned, or a bit less an economic risk.
When did that first start? Appearing to a point that it was debilitating you.
Depression is, you don't know when it starts because it kind of sneaks up in you. I always consider it like a freezing fog and you're in a huge globe like a fishbowl filled with excrement, a jello that's made out of excrement, and you're in the middle of it and you're afraid to open your mouth and scream because you might drown. And you can't reach anything, including yourself. And then you go through stages where you even go below self-pity. You know, we all have that. You feel sorry for yourself. And one day you don't care. If my wife could smell me downstairs because I didn't wash or anything. If my ex-wife, if she wasn't there, I would have laid in my own waste matter up in my bed no matter what. You didn't shave, you didn't wash, you didn't talk, you didn't walk, you didn't do anything, you know. And extremely painful and extremely misunderstood. That's why now that's my second profession, to fight the stigma connected with mental diseases. I once appeared with Mrs. Rosalind Carter. I think it was down here, I'm not sure. I've been on panels, I went to Washington and appeared before Congress, before anybody, I think, to raise money to fight the stigma against mental diseases, you know, and that.
How do you work yourself out of that? What does one do?
Well, it took me almost a decade. What it came about was each one of us is a different chemical machine. And that's why I never mention what medicine I take, because if you needed something or somebody needed something, they take it and it doesn't work for them because their chemistry is different. You may have a new alcoholic or a suicide on your hands. So it takes time to find the right pill or thing that will chemically adjust my chemical imbalance of the brain. And also talk therapy and both of them should go together. You know, in my opinion, and find the right doc. Now, this is the big point. I was lucky because I had some money in the bank. What does the average person who has to go to work from 9 to 5 do in that situation? And how do they do it? I am amazed by that courage. I don't know how you do that. I was so lucky. I begin to run out of money after a while, but I don't know how a person does that, and it is like being in cold swamp of molasses. It pulls on your skin, every part of your body, as you try to walk forward. And they do it. They get the rent. And I bow in most humbly to those people. $40, $80 a week, they got to do it. They got to feed the kids. I don't know how they do it.
It must be like walking into a new world, though, when you finally do get the chemical ingredients right, then can
well,
come back to the
gradually.
World again.
That starts gradually. I always, sometimes I say, you know, like you ask me, keep asking me what time it is. Ask me.
What time is it?
It looks like 10 minutes to 11.
What time is it, Rod?
You're about 10 minutes to 11.
And what time is it?
10 minutes 11.
What time is it?
I don't have a watch. You're in it. And it starts in little ways. You look at something 2 seconds like I did longer, then 10 seconds. And finally you're sitting there looking at the flowers, but not seeing them. And we have to realize that this is just as bad as cancer. Many suicides and all that. Good morning. This is The Breakfast Show. We are here to entertain you and make you laugh and smile.
After On the Waterfront, Fred Zinnemann cast you again, this time in Oklahoma.
Yeah,
musical.
Played Judd in Oklahoma.
Yes, and you sang on screen?
Well, I was scared to death because I was a frustrated opera singer, and I thought, Jesus, I changed keys, I won't know it. And then they announced to me, well, you're going to sing a duet with Gordon McRae. I said, oh, my Lord. I mean, Gordon had a natural voice, was a good musician. So anyway, I said, okay, now comes the day, you know, you sing it on the screen, but you record it later. And I said, well, I got to go. And I walk into stage 25 at MGM, which looks like Grand Central Station, and there's nothing there. There's a microphone, and hanging on top of it are the earphones. I'm looking for the orchestra. I'm looking for Gordon. A voice from behind a glass shield says, all right, Rod, we're ready now. I said, okay. And I put the things on, and I hear, I think it was the New York Philharmonic, bum, bum, ba-bum. I said, this is it.
Poor Judd is dead.
This is where I get killed. And I started to sing, Poor Judd is Dead. And it was funny, because when I sang it with Gordon, or when I started to sing, Poor Judd is Dead, candle lights. They said, no, you sound exactly like Gordon. I was a dramatic tenor. He was a lyric baritone, a light bear. So I had to sing, poor, 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 poor Judd is dead. And I got away with it. It took me about an hour and a half, and I apologized. And they said, listen, we have people come in here who are professional singers. And two bars, we can be for a half hour. I said, you're joking. But nobody was there.
Where was Gordon?
He had recorded already.
He recorded his part, his duet with you separately.
He came on an earphone. I'm standing in the middle of the Coliseum, for Christ's sakes, with these ear things on. Oh, my God, I'll never forget that.
You also danced in the movie, in a ballet.
I don't think there was any need to bring that up, really. I said that Agnes DeMille, the great choreographer and a great artist, they said, Rod, we're looking for somebody because for your shoulders and your heaviness from the back, we can't find a dancer. So I said, okay. About 10 days later, she calls me up and said, Rod, this is Agnes. I said, yes, Mr. Mills. She said, we found somebody. I said, really? She said, yeah, you come down to the studio and I'll introduce them to you. So I come down to the studio, I walk, and I said, where is she? She said, you. I said, come on, Agnes, I can't do a ballet. She says, count to four. I said, one, two, three, four. She said, you'll do it. And when she said you'll do something, you did it. So I'm going around. Thank God it was lumbering. One, two, three. And the most frightening thing for me was not the dancing. I had to lift Bambi Lynn, a ballet dancer, weighed about 120 pounds, over my head at the end, and I had to walk through beeswax smoke. Let me explain. That's the smoke they make out of beeswax to give you the cloud effect or fire effect or smoke effect. And it stings your eyes and it hits your throat. And I lifted her over 16 times. They want to get the lighting right. They want to get this. The last time, my arms were trembling underneath the costume. And all I was thinking is, sure, drop her, you idiot. Drop her, break her leg. She's finished as a dancer. Wonderful. You going to do another one? Yeah, oh, okay. I'll never forget that. And the beeswax smoke.
Moving on, the same period, you did The Big Knife, which was a powerhouse story about Hollywood.
I want to do that again. I think that would be received much better today, you know. Hollywood didn't like that we did it because Big Knife was the story of a man who was an actor. They wanted him to sign this contract, which was for a lot of money. He wanted to protect his freedom of choice, and I played the head of the studio. And thank goodness I was not in Hollywood when some of the big evil guys were around, you know. They said, oh, you're doing so-and-so. No, I said, I wasn't here then, yeah. And I didn't know what to do in the part. And again, I have, this is a very good thing. As an actor or anything else, on days you don't, your imagination seems dead. I said, okay, I walked into like Saks Fifth Avenue, and I start on the first floor. And the name of my character is Stanley Huff. And I say, okay, what do toys mean to Stanley Huff? Second floor, what do perfume mean to Stanley Huff? All sports goods, all the way. And I'm in the men's department finally, and I said, and I'm about to walk out, and I see this box, and in this box are tie tacks, and I'm about to leave, and I see one is a silver question mark. And I thought Huff was a latent homosexual behind it all, because his attitude towards women was terrible. When Ida Lupino came in as the wife, he says, what is the woman doing here? And so I wore it in the film. And when I used to get nervous in the scene, I'd be sitting going, nobody knew what I was doing. But that consolidated the thing. So again, see, you don't know where it's going to come from. Mm-hmm. Not only knowing about acting technique, but and of course, the one thing they can't supply, which is the basis of talent, is imagination. Nobody's going to teach you that.
So you didn't necessarily base it on a Harry Cohen or a
No,
LB
I didn't
Mayer.
Know him. Louis B. Mayer, was that it?
Yeah, Louis
Everybody
B. Mayer.
Said, no. Yeah, I based it on that, and I also, this shows you, about 5 months before I was passing the New York Health Club in New York, and this guy came running down the steps in a silk mohair suit, blazing beautiful silver hair, deep tan, and I remembered him. And when I got the part of Stanley, I said, wait a minute. I'll have the suit, I have the deep tan, I'll have the silver hair. So there you are again. You never know where it's going to come from.
There are always rumors that that story was based on John Garfield as well.
I don't know about that. It might have been because Odette's was...
And I think Garfield played it originally in New York, didn't he?
I don't remember.
On the stage.
But the problem with that theory was that movie was basically an economic problem. By that, I mean the average man making about $50 a week. And he's going to worry about a guy who's worried about signing a $2 million contract?
Right.
No, that was only for we in the arts, we would understand that. But the working man said, what the hell are you? Sign! Mm-hmm. You know, so it didn't connect with the general public.
You and Jack Palance have a great moment in The Big Knife when he slaps you. Could you describe that a little bit?
Well, what happened in that was, first of all, there was a lot of crap going around. People go, oh, boy, I can't wait to see when Jack Palance meets Rod Steiger, blah, blah, blah. And of course, both of us were fairly professional. There was no personal problems whatsoever. But I know he had a very strong personality, very strong physically. So in the scene, I say, I'm going to leave, whatever it is the head of the studio, Stanley Huff. And I started to walk out, and I heard these footsteps coming behind me. And I was scared.
So this wasn't in the script?
Oh, no, no. Most of the good moments anybody does are not in the script. They come from it. So I hear this, and I turn around like that, like a frightened child, which was another expose of Stanley Hoff. And he looks at me, and I'm waiting for this. And he just goes with disdain and walks away. And then I'm supposed to say, Charlie, you're through. You are through. And I said, Charlie, the house goes, the paintings go, the furniture goes, your wife is gonna go, and you're through. You know, so it worked out okay, you know, I remember that. I was saying everything goes. The cockroaches go, the carpet goes. You know.
Great.
Yeah.
You also made Humphrey Bogart's last film, The Harder They Fall.
Oh, he was such a nice man. He and I was very flattered, got along very well. And he would come in exactly at 9 o'clock. And he would leave exactly at 6 o'clock. If it was 1 minute after six, they said, Bogey, the scene's going. I know. He said, what time is it? 6 o'clock. He said, that's right. I'll see you tomorrow. Always knew his lines. Very profound. He came from the theater. He was in 7 successful hits on Broadway in a row. And can you believe it? Humphrey Bogart was the one that said, tennis, anyone? It just didn't fit, you know. But we get along very well. And finally, one day, I get tipped off. Because my dressing room looked like the actor's studio of the West Coast. Everybody was in there, all the guys I knew, we'd sit and carry on. And I was tipped off. He had got one of these newspapers that you can have made up with any headline. And it said, Brando comes to town, Steiger leaves. Right? So I didn't say anything. And he comes bouncing in. I said, how are you doing, Rod? I said, I'm fine. His eyes are going, boy. He got me, right? And he whips out the paper, and I whip out one at the same time. And my says, Bogart works with Steiger, is suicide, right? And we both came at the same time. And he laughed. And then the saddest thing I remember, one day I was working on the picture and I'm going to get some lunch at the commissary, and there he is walking down. I said, Bogey, what are you doing? You don't work today. And he said, well, you know, I gotta do some close-ups again. My eyes were watery. And I didn't pay any attention. It shows you how insensitive I was. About a month or so later, he died. He was in pain. That's why his eyes were watery. And he never said a word, you know. Lovely man.
You seem to have two different acting styles, though. Did he fit that improvisational style that you were trained in, or?
Well, Bogart was a fine actor in his way, which is representational. Representational is when I'm explaining to the public. You do what you think the character's going to do. Then my generation came along, and they said, no, no, this is happening to you. And when you take on the problems of this person called the character, personally, you become the character. But basically what was involved, this man had said, I mean, he was a good actor, so it could all blend. It doesn't make any difference what your background is, because basically you really come out. You know, I'm sure he did. He knew how to identify with a part because he was Humphrey Bogart. I mean, you know, he was a love. I regret the day he said, my eyes are watering.
Shortly after that, you went to Europe to work quite a bit, across the bridge.
Well, because in Europe I found better material, which you still find today. Sorry, folks in Hollywood, but that's the truth. And I found Across the Bridge, and I found these other pictures that I loved. And also gets back to my problem with my mother and alcohol and the reputation of my family in the neighborhood. You get off the plane in Europe, they say, Mr. Steiger, this way. Mr. Steiger, this is your car. Mr. Steiger, this is your dream. You get off the plane in Hollywood today, and some young guy who've never seen an assistant director says, Rod, baby, we're ready to shoot. So you control yourself and say, okay, I'm ready to shoot. So that was the basic thing. I go, you see, a part is like you go to a cocktail party and you see this woman. She's gorgeous. She selects you. You want to take her home. You want to get to know her better. And wherever a good part is, I've done a movie in Cairo, my friend, that I'd rather not talk about. My God, I worked with an actress who got up 4:30 in the morning, and she glued on each eyelash, right? So no matter what happened, you said, are you hungry? Oh, I'm all right. Yes, I'm hungry. He said, your mother died. Oh, really? Didn't my mother die? Because she couldn't change an expression. Silvia Magnanimo, Italian actress, many years ago. Never forgot that.
You never directed a film. Were you ever tempted?
Not officially, no. I haven't directed.
Well, you had to...
Well, I was asked for many years to direct, but it's not like in Europe. No one will touch a director's picture in Europe. But I don't want to break my rear end for 2 years trying to get something right, and some guy in the front office says, well, maybe we should cut that scene, or maybe we need a little more humor. And that's what happens, basically. The mercantile people have very little respect for the creative people. And if a guy, you know... That's another thing, and people might want to deny it, but the higher your budget, unconsciously, the less creative will be your choice. You got a picture for $100 million, and a guy said, well, I want to come in the door backwards, and then turn around, and they said, no, sweetheart, it's $100 million. You'll come in the door like everybody else comes in the door. If it's $3 million, you can pirouette and come through the door, maybe, you know. So, again, your artistic freedom is cramped by the budget, unless you fight it. And if you're any kind of creative actor, you fight it. And of course, they say you're difficult. It's a bunch of junk, you know.
Al Capone is a film.
Oh,
that you
sorry.
No.
About the directing, you know, I don't want to have. If I can't be around for the edit, editing is the backbone of movies. Editors don't get the credit they're due. You got, for instance, a guy who cannot act, and he's going to do a drunk scene. And you say to yourself as a director, what am I going to do? So you say to him, I tell you what, you walk in, you're very tired, and you get in the chair, you slump down, and that bottle of wine, when you put your head down and relax, you knock over accidentally, okay? Now, the editor comes in, you see the guy coming in, he cuts to a clock, it's 3 o'clock, he cuts to the guy sitting down, he cuts to the bottle of wine, he cuts to the guy with his head down, he cuts to the wine on the floor, he comes up and there's the guy, he cuts to the clock, 3 hours have gone by, he drunk. This guy couldn't play a drunk if his rear end depended on it. But the editor makes it so. The editor, they don't get the credit they're due. They're really the backbone of a film. And they can also, a bad editor can louse you up.
Al Capone, you were offered that many times, turned it down.
Well, I was offered and I said, I don't want to play him. I don't want to play him. They said, why? I said, because I don't like him. I don't like this guy. I don't want to set an example. And finally, they called me in one more time. And they, you know... They were going to give me $1, $2, $3, $4, $10. I said, you don't understand. I do not like him. Right? And I said, I also don't like the script. Now, I live a crazy way, you know, I guess. I don't know. And this young idiot, schmutzy producer says to me, well, if you don't like the script, why don't you rewrite it? You don't say that to Wild Bill Hickok. I looked at him, I said, give me the script, okay? And 30 days later, I came back and rewrote it. I brought him a cast list, Nehemiah Persson, of all these people they'd never heard of from the studio. And I told the guys, just remember one thing, you become a gangster when you pick up the gun. Let's not change our voices, let's not get tough, let us do just like human beings, you know? And we did it. Oh, I said to him, I still don't want to do it. And the guy said, I said, I'll tell you what, and this is how I helped bring rehearsals, I think, into films a little bit. I said, and I figured this will get him. I want 10 days rehearsal. And I got the response I wanted. 10 days with nothing on the screen? I said, yeah, 10 days rehearsal, nothing photographed. Get out. I said, thank you. 3 days later, I get a call, and the guy said, we'll give you 7. And then I said, this is the way I think. I said, look, we've been playing poker here all this month, and you're calling my bluff. Let's see what the hell happens. And I went and did it.
Are you glad you did?
Yeah. The only thing I didn't like was I had a big fight with they had a big fight with the Hayes office or whatever it was at that time, who kind of make sure films weren't too sick or something. I don't know what's happened since then. And they said he died of a social disease. I said, no, we got to use the word syphilis. It'll scare the younger people. He died of syphilis. Oh, God. They wouldn't let us change it. Mm-hmm. I never got over. I was so angry. Now you can say anything, you know.
Now, not long after that came The Pawnbroker. One of the great films, one of the great performances.
That's my favorite.
Is it?
Yeah. This is a story of a man whose his family gets crushed to death in a boxcar when they're taking him to Auschwitz. He's at the other end of it, and he can't get there to save him. And, of course, he couldn't have saved him if he had 10,000 men with him. But he becomes obsessed with this guilt that somehow he should have been able to do something. So this obsession makes him want to exist without living, without participating. And I believe, you know, whether you like it or not, if you breathe, you have some responsibility to the society in which you exist. But nevertheless, he tried to do it. And I cut one third of my lines in that picture. And if you'll watch in the beginning of the picture, he hardly looks anybody in the eye, you know. And he's got this pawn shop now in Spanish Harlem. And he's got this tattoo. And the beginning of him looking at anybody in the picture comes, oh, I don't know, 5-10 minutes into the film. And one of the guys that comes in to pawn something says, what's the tattoo for? And that's my favorite line in the picture. He looks at him, he says, the tattoo? That's for walking on water. $2. That line, I don't know why. And that, to me, is my favorite film, you know. Saul Lazarman.
Did that come from out of nowhere?
Not really. Sidney Lumet was directing it, and I had done with Sidney, my God, on television, Henry Vyshinsky, Rudolf Hess, Dutch Schultz, Steinmetz, the electrical wizard on You Were There. So I was kind of, at that time, his boy, you know. And he said, this guy, he's only 30-something, but he's going to play it. And I said, what are you doing with me? You can't have him. And when I came in for the first rehearsal, everybody was, Jesus, he's a little young for the part, isn't he? And, of course, I work, it depends on the part, but I work rather slowly. I start just with talking and listening and try to discover as I go along. Anyway, it came off all right, and it's my favorite picture. And the other thing which was kind of ironic and funny in that picture is there's a scene where he flagellates himself. He pushes the spike where you put bills on through his hand. And I was at home working my rear end off, trying to get the hand here, push it, let's get it, right? And we started to shoot the next day, and it was going perfect. I forgot to rehearse taking it off. I was so obsessed with getting it on, right? So we're shooting, and I'm going. And in the middle of the take, I remember, I said, you don't know, how do you never rehearsed taking it off to myself. This goes in the millionth of a second. So I remember when I was in real pain, one of my habits was to go, and I got out of it. But for a second, I figured, oh, wonderful brain. Really, you're a great actor, Rod.
There's also an incredible moment with your silent scream in that movie.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I came out seen as the boy who I've grown to love as a son is lying, dying in the gutter outside my pawn shop. And I came out and I kneeled down at 128th Street in Harlem. And I put my hands in the chocolate syrup, since the picture was black and white, that looked like his blood. And I thought of my daughter, and she was lying there. And I looked, and then I put my head back to scream, and I remembered Picasso's painting of Guernica, the massive painting with these people with their heads back and their mouths open and these pointed tongues come out. One of the loudest screams I ever heard. Of course, there was no sound, but that's the impression you got. And something, and this is where the intellect and the instinct comes together. That's what I think is the most interesting moments in life, as well as acting. Your intellect, your instincts come together. And something said, do not make a sound. And I put my head back, and I didn't scream. And they were so afraid of that moment. They left most of it in, but just at the very end, when they shouldn't still have done nothing, you hear the first beat of the music. But it worked. It worked. Again, you don't know where things are going to come from in your life, as a person or as an actor, whatever it is.
Incredible moment. I understand they had trouble getting a release for the film. Is that true?
They had trouble because there was a scene where they take Sal Nazeman, that was my character. He's in the concentration camp. They push his head through the glass of a window, and he sees sitting in a cell his wife completely nude, about to be abused by a Nazi, and they pan slowly down the row of cells, and you see these other women being abused or about to be abused by the Nazis. Well, because of the nudity, they went this back and forth, and we got permission. The first film ever, because of why they were naked. And then, of course, later on, people came along and abused it. And said, well, they were naked in the pawnbroker. Why can't, you know? So that's the bad side of it. But the good side of it was absolutely logical and necessary, so you didn't dilute the power in the visual image on the screen to what was going on.